In case you have forgotten, we are at the end of a series of lessons in Revelation. There's been some interruption in that series with our trip to India. And after today, there will be a little more interruption before we continue. Next Sunday afternoon, we're planning to have Eric Borlaug speak to us for the conclusion of our gospel meeting with him. And then the following Sunday is a fourth Sunday singing, and then the following Sunday would be a fifth Sunday in March, where traditionally somebody who's not me preaches. So if we stick to that, it'll at least be a few more weeks before we come back to this series. But since it has been a while, I thought it would be good for us to review just a little bit about where we are. And here is the big picture overview of the way I see Revelation being presented to us. It's a book that comes in two main sections. Here I'm calling them the first act and the second act because the story is presented to us very visually, like a play on a stage, or if you prefer, like seasons of a television show. So I've also called these sections season one and season two. But on either side, there is an intro and a conclusion, which I'm calling the prologue and the epilogue. So that prologue section is chapters 1 through 3. The first act is chapters 4 through 11. The second act is chapters 12 through 20. And that epilogue is chapters 21 and 22. And if you recall, the first act, or the first season, was centered around this scroll that appeared in chapter 4. We saw this scene where all of heaven is centered around the throne of God, and the scroll actually appears at the beginning of chapter 5. Because at the beginning of chapter 5, there is some consternation, because there is nobody who is able to open this scroll. Nobody is found worthy to open it, until we see the Lion of the tribe of Judah. And heaven rejoices because he is worthy to take the scroll and to open its seals. Only he looks like a lamb who's standing as though he had been slain. And the reason why he is worthy to open this scroll is because he has purchased or ransomed people for God with his blood. And so I think we ought to see chapter 5 as being like the other side of the ascension. Jesus has completed his work of redemption on earth with his sacrifice and his resurrection from the dead, and now he has ascended to heaven, and we see what follows after that. But before we really know what this scroll is about, we see the seals being opened one by one. And all seven of these seals have some association with judgment. And by the time the final seal is opened, I believe it becomes clear to us what this scroll is. That it's actually the scroll that was given to Daniel in Daniel chapter 12. A scroll that he was told would be for the shattering of the holy people. And the bottom line of the first act is that the physical nation of Israel is being destroyed. The physical temple in Jerusalem is being destroyed. But it is a great revealing of the true Israel and the true temple, because even though these physical things are passing away, the spiritual reality remains in Jesus and his church. And so in my estimation, the first part of the book is focused on the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD. But then the second part of the book begins in chapter 12. And with this second act, there's a whole new cast of characters. We're introduced to a dragon, and the dragon is identified as that ancient serpent who is called the devil and Satan, the deceiver of the whole world. And we saw in chapter 12 how he would like to stop the Messiah from being born, or at least to stop the Messiah from accomplishing his work on earth before he can. But the dragon fails, and because he knows that he's failed, he's very angry, and he takes out his anger on the people of Jesus. He's pursuing this woman in the wilderness. And so in chapters 13 and 14, we see this dragon recruit some allies. And he has three main allies: the sea beast, the land beast, and the great prostitute. And these three allies bring about persecution, false teaching, and temptation. And we talked about how those are Satan's three main tools consistently against God's people: persecution, false teaching, and temptation. But specifically, at this point in history, Satan is using the Roman Empire to bring these things about. And so the sea beast represents the military might of the Roman Empire. And the land beast, also known as the false prophet, represents the false religion of the Roman Empire. And then the great prostitute, whose name is Babylon, represents the worldly influence of the Roman Empire. And we saw how we should respond to each one of those. When we're persecuted, we should endure. When we're presented with false teaching, we need wisdom and discernment. And when we are presented with temptation, we need to choose to be faithful to the Lord. Well, in the last lesson, we looked at chapters 15 and 16, which were previews of God's judgment against all of his enemies. Although the dragon and his allies continue to resist God's plan and purposes, God continues to triumph over them for the sake of his people. And all of that brings us to chapters 17 and 18, which we will be looking at today. So my plan is to complete this series with two additional lessons after today, and we will get to those as soon as the schedule allows. But we'll pick up here in Revelation 17, verses 1 through 6. And if you'd like to open your Bibles, you can follow along as we read. It says, "Then one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came and said to me, 'Come, I will show you the judgment of the great prostitute who is seated on many waters, with whom the kings of the earth have committed sexual immorality, and with the wine of whose sexual immorality the dwellers on earth have become drunk.' And he carried me away in the spirit into a wilderness, and I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast that was full of blasphemous names, and it had seven heads and ten horns. The woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet, and adorned with gold and jewels and pearls, holding in her hand a golden cup full of abominations and the impurities of her sexual immorality. And on her forehead was written a name of mystery: Babylon the Great, mother of prostitutes and of earth's abominations. And I saw the woman drunk with the blood of the saints, the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. When I saw her, I marveled greatly." Now, we saw Babylon mentioned for the first time back in chapter 14. And when we were there, we noticed that her fate, her downfall, was predicted before we had even been properly introduced to her. Revelation 14 and verse 8, another angel, a second, followed, saying, "Fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great, she who made all nations drink the wine of the passion of her sexual immorality." And so here we get a fuller picture of this woman and what her crimes are. As we've already established, Babylon represents an element of Rome. This sexual immorality that she is pictured with represents unfaithfulness to God. And consistently, in the Old and New Testament, sexual immorality is often coupled with idolatry. Because when we are unfaithful to the God that we belong to, that's idolatry. That's akin to sexual immorality. And so here is this woman who is presenting the opulence and the splendor and the wealth and the prosperity of Rome. And with all of that is the worldly influence that tempted Christians in the first century and continues to tempt Christians all over the world today, including us. But so here, this woman is called the great prostitute because of her relationship with the kings of the earth. She's tempted them with her assets and seduced them with her worldliness. And she's made the whole world drunk with the wine of her immorality. And all of this has been in direct opposition to Jesus and to his people. Verse 6 tells us that she is drunk with the blood of the saints, the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. And so this is a picture of a woman. It's a rather grotesque picture of a woman who is just very worldly, very obnoxiously wealthy and self-absorbed, but she has this worldly influence on all the people around her. And everyone who has gotten in bed with her has fallen for her allure of pleasure, wealth, and power. But she's also pictured in verse 1, sitting on the waters. And in verse 3, she's pictured sitting on a scarlet beast. And verse 3 also tells us that this scarlet beast is full of blasphemous names, and it has 7 heads and 10 horns. Now, these descriptions would identify this beast with the beast that we saw in chapter 13. So if you go back and look in chapter 13, remember the first ally that the devil recruits. In verse 1 is a beast rising out of the sea with 10 horns and 7 heads, with 10 diadems on its horns and blasphemous names on its heads. And so here, the picture in chapter 17 is that this great prostitute is riding on this sea beast. Or in other words, the wealth, the worldliness, the tempting influence of Rome is being carried by Rome's military might and military power. That as Rome continues to expand and conquer territories and rule with a strong iron fist, that Rome is continuing to spread this worldly kind of influence as its territory expands. And so, Christians are being persecuted and tempted everywhere that the empire grows to. And the next section helps us to understand more specifically what these figures represent. So we're starting to put some of these pictures together. And verses 7 through 18 is one of those sections where we get a little bit of help in interpretation. So let's go ahead and read those verses and see if we can make sense of some of this. Revelation 17, continuing in verse 7. But the angel said to me, "Why do you marvel? I will tell you the mystery of the woman and of the beast with 7 heads and 10 horns that carries her. The beast that you saw was and is not and is about to rise from the bottomless pit and go to destruction. And the dwellers on earth, whose names have not been written in the book of life from the foundation of the world, will marvel to see the beast because it was and is not and is to come. This calls for a mind with wisdom. The 7 heads are 7 mountains on which the woman is seated. They are also 7 kings, 5 of whom have fallen, 1 is, the other has not yet come, and when he does come, he must remain only a little while. As for the beast that was and is not, it is 1/8, but it belongs to the 7, and it goes to destruction. And the 10 horns that you saw are 10 kings who have not yet received royal power, but they are to receive authority as kings for 1 hour together with the beast. These are of 1 mind, and they hand over their power and authority to the beast. They will make war on the Lamb, and the Lamb will conquer them, for he is Lord of lords and King of kings, and those with him are called and chosen and faithful. And the angel said to me, "The waters that you saw where the prostitute is seated are peoples and multitudes and nations and languages, and the 10 horns that you saw, they and the beast will hate the prostitute. They will make her desolate and naked and devour her flesh and burn her up with fire, for God has put it into their hearts to carry out his purpose by being of 1 mind and handing over their royal power to the beast until the words of God are fulfilled. And the woman that you saw is the great city that has dominion over the kings of the earth." All right, you get all that? Maybe the part that we identify with the most is the part where the angel says, "This calls for a mind with wisdom." Yes, it takes some effort to discern exactly what's being told to us here. And there's a lot packed into this. And I'll just go ahead and tell you up front. There are many differing opinions about how to interpret this section. And I think that there are probably a few different possibilities for how to understand this. But I've been studying this for a while, and I'm going to present a view that makes the most sense to me. And hopefully it makes sense to you, but if it doesn't, we don't have to fight too much about it. But this is a difficult section. But it is meant to help us understand, because the angel is taking this opportunity to explain some of the visions that John has been seeing. In fact, in verse 7, the angel tells John, "I will tell you the mystery of the woman and of the beast with 7 heads and 10 horns that carries her." Now, I take that statement to mean that the angel is about to help John make the connection between the vision that he's seeing and some literal people, some literal interpretations of these figures that he's been seeing in a vision. It's very similar to what we saw right at the beginning of the book. If you remember back in Revelation chapter 1, in verse 20, that John had seen a vision of Jesus standing in the midst of 7 golden lampstands. And in chapter 1, in verse 20, he's told, "As for the mystery of the 7 stars that you saw in my right hand and the 7 golden lampstands, the 7 stars are the angels of the 7 churches, and the 7 lampstands are the 7 churches. So in chapter 1, John was told that he would have this mystery of the 7 lampstands revealed to him, and those 7 lampstands represented 7 actual churches in Asia Minor. Chapters 2 and 3 name those 7 churches. They're Ephesus, Smyrna, Pergamum, Thyatira, Sardis, Philadelphia, and Laodicea. Now, compare that to what we just read in Revelation 17 and verse 9, where he says, "This calls for a mind with wisdom. The 7 heads are 7 mountains on which the woman is seated. They are also 7 kings, 5 of whom have fallen, 1 is, the other has not yet come, and when he does come, he must remain only a little while. As for the beast that was and is not, it is 1/8, but it belongs to the 7, and it goes to destruction." So just like those 7 golden lampstands represented 7 actual churches in Asia Minor, I believe what John is being told is that the 7 heads represent 7 actual Roman emperors, and the beast represents 1/8. Now, when he says that this verse 9, that the 7 heads are 7 mountains on which the woman is seated, first century readers would understand that as a very explicit reference to Rome. Rome is well documented as being the city that is built on 7 hills or 7 mountains. And so the 7 heads that represent 7 mountains are a very direct identification of Babylon with Rome. But then verse 10 tells us the 7 heads also represent 7 kings. And verse 11 tells us the beast itself represents 1/8 king that belongs to the 7. So, here is a list of Roman emperors, and we'll start with the first Roman emperor, who is Augustus Caesar. The reason we're not starting with Julius is because Julius ruled over the Roman Republic. He was appointed as a dictator over the Republic, but Augustus is actually the first Roman emperor of the Roman Empire. And so if we start with Augustus, and we count 5 of whom have fallen, then that means that we've made it through the reign of Nero. So Augustus, Tiberius, Caligula, Claudius, and Nero are the five kings who have fallen. And as you can see on the chart, I'm going to tell you that the one who is Vespasian, and the one who has not yet come, and when he does come, must remain only a little while, is Titus, and the eighth who goes to destruction is Domitian. Well, your first question is probably, why would I skip Galba, Otho, and Vitellius? Well, if you look here, you see how short their reigns are. 69 AD was known as the year of the four emperors. And the reason why is because when Emperor Nero died in 68, he left a power vacuum, and it wasn't clear who the next emperor would be. And so within the span of 1 year, there were four different emperors who tried to claim the throne, and all of their reigns were very, very short-lived. They either died by assassination or by suicide. And so it wasn't until Vespasian took the throne that stability was restored to the empire. Now, that might not be enough reason alone to skip those three, but there's a biblical reason why I think we could skip these three also, and that's because of the vision in Daniel chapter 7. So if you want to, you can flip back to Daniel 7, and I want to remind you of this connection that we've seen to the book of Revelation. Remember, Daniel interpreted Nebuchadnezzar's dream in Daniel chapter 2. And in that dream, Nebuchadnezzar saw four parts of a statue that represented four empires that would rise throughout history. He was told that Babylon was the first, but then after Babylon would come the Medo-Persians, and after the Persians would be the Greeks, and after the Greeks would be the Romans. And so the Romans are the fourth part of the statue. It was during the days of the Roman Empire that the kingdom of heaven came to earth. Well, in Daniel chapter 7, Daniel sees a dream, not of four parts of a statue, but of four different beasts that rise out of the sea. And those four beasts are the same four kingdoms that are listed in Daniel chapter 2. And the fourth beast is very similar to the beast that we read about in Revelation 13 and 17. And we made that connection before. Because that beast in Revelation 13 and Revelation 17 represents the Roman Empire. But if you look specifically at what Daniel sees about that fourth beast in Daniel chapter 7, it says here in verse 7, "After this I saw in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, terrifying and dreadful and exceedingly strong. It had great iron teeth. It devoured and broke in pieces and stamped what was left with its feet. It was different from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. I considered the horns, and behold, there came up among them another horn, a little one, before which three of the first horns were plucked up by the roots. And behold, in this horn were eyes like the eyes of a man, and a mouth speaking great things." So, in Daniel's vision, in Daniel chapter 7, he's specifically told that this beast has three horns that are plucked up by the roots. That sounds to me a lot like what happened in the year of the four emperors, that Galba, Otho, and Vitellius were plucked up by the roots before they could really establish their kingship. And most of the Roman Empire wouldn't have really even recognized them as emperors because they came and went before they could really establish their reign. And so, if we take this to mean that these three don't count, then we've got five emperors who have fallen, the first five. We've got one who is Vespasian. One who will come and only remain for a little while, who is Titus. And notice that Titus only reigns for a couple of years. That's a very short reign compared to some of the others. And then the eighth who goes to destruction will be Domitian. That makes sense for a couple of reasons. If we do understand the first part of this book to be talking about the fall of Jerusalem in 70 AD, This would allow us to date the book at late 69 or early 70 AD, at the beginning of Vespasian's reign. And also, it would explain what Revelation is telling us about the beast who was and is not and is about to rise from the bottomless pit and go to destruction. It tells us that the beast was and is not and is to come. If the beast is representing the persecution that comes with the military strength of Rome, persecution against Christians increased up until Nero. But then, because of this period of civil war, Rome had to deal with internal issues, and persecution against Christians actually died down. But then it began to come back again and came really to a head with Domitian, who intensified and spread the Roman persecution of Christians. And so it was and is not and is to come. And so I take that to mean that Domitian is this eighth who goes to destruction. With him, persecution of Christians will intensify and spread. And so it's a good thing we've got a nice big screen to see this table with tonight. So take that and think about it. This is what makes the most sense to me. But the point that we ought to see in all of this is that no matter what the world thinks about this beast, no matter what the world thinks about the military strength of Rome, no matter what they think about the power that it has, the beast's days are numbered. And in fact, in Revelation 17 and verse 12, it tells us that these 10 horns receive authority as kings for 1 hour. In verse 14, they make war on the Lamb, but the Lamb will conquer them, for he is Lord of lords and King of kings, and those with him are called and chosen and faithful. From all appearances, Rome and its glory and its power would seem like it was incomparable and everlasting. But given enough time, the world would see who the true glory belongs to. It's not to any of these Roman Caesars. And it's not to the citizens of the kingdom of Rome, but it's to the one who is King of Kings and to those who are citizens of the kingdom of heaven. And so the book of Revelation is reassuring us that no matter how things look now, that ultimately Jesus is the king and his people will be triumphant. And when the angel goes on to explain the waters and the horns here in Revelation 17, I think he's talking about the way Rome will fall. He says in verse 15 that the waters represent all the different peoples, and in verse 16 that the horns and the beast will actually hate the prostitute, make her desolate, naked, devour her flesh, and burn her up with fire, for God has put it into their hearts to carry out his purpose by being of one mind and handing over their royal power to the beast until the words of God are fulfilled. Ultimately, Rome will turn on itself. This isn't a system that can be sustained forever. When everybody is just partnering with each other out of selfish motives, selfish ambitions, that's a very tenuous kind of partnership. And eventually, this system will fall apart. Rome will fracture from the inside out. It will crumble like iron and clay mixed together. And so all of these people who are united by worldly interest will eventually turn on each other and lead to destruction. God is using Rome to accomplish his purposes in the world. In the Old Testament, he used the literal nation of Babylon. But after he had used Babylon to bring judgment to Israel, he turned around and dealt with Babylon also. And in the New Testament, we see him doing a very similar thing. This time, Babylon is Rome. But after he finishes using Babylon to bring judgment to Israel, he will turn around and deal with Babylon also. The only kingdom that will last forever is the kingdom of heaven. Well, that brings us to chapter 18, which is all about the fall of Babylon and the responses to Babylon's fall. And if we pick up reading here in Revelation 18 and verse 1, it says, "After this I saw another angel coming down from heaven, having great authority, and the earth was made bright with his glory. And he called out with a mighty voice, 'Fallen, fallen is Babylon the great. She has become a dwelling place for demons, a haunt for every unclean spirit, a haunt for every unclean bird, a haunt for every unclean and detestable beast. For all nations have drunk the wine of the passion of her sexual immorality, and the kings of the earth have committed immorality with her, and the merchants of the earth have grown rich from the power of her luxurious living.' Then I heard another voice from heaven saying, 'Come out of her, my people, lest you take part in her sins, lest you share in her plagues. For her sins are heaped high as heaven, and God has remembered her iniquities. Pay her back as she herself has paid back others, and repay her double for her deeds. Mix a double portion for her in the cup she mixed. As she glorified herself and lived in luxury, so give her a like measure of torment and mourning. Since in her heart she says, 'I sit as a queen, I am no widow, and mourning I shall never see.' For this reason her plagues will come in a single day, death and mourning and famine, and she will be burned up with fire. For mighty is the Lord God who has judged her." Now, we already looked at the announcement of Babylon's fall back in chapter 14 and verse 8. And the same thing is said here, now that we see it happening, in chapter 18 and verse 1. Fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great. And I think the most important thing for us to notice here is the instruction to God's people in verse 4. As Babylon is falling, the instruction is, get out while you can. Don't go down with the sinking ship. Come out of her, my people, lest you take part in her sins, lest you share in her plagues. Babylon is doomed to destruction, and so the only way to escape her fate is by separating yourselves from her. That's the point that the voice from heaven wants God's people to understand. Well, the rest of this chapter is showing us the responses to Babylon's fall. And I want to read the rest of the chapter, and I want you to notice that there are three groups lamenting the fall of Babylon here. There are the kings of the earth, starting in verse 9, the merchants of the earth, starting in verse 11, and the shipmasters and sailors, starting in verse 17. So starting in verse 9, "The kings of the earth who committed sexual immorality and lived in luxury with her will weep and wail over her when they see the smoke of her burning. They will stand far off in fear of her torment and say, 'Alas, alas, you great city, you mighty city Babylon, for in a single hour your judgment has come.' And the merchants of the earth weep and mourn for her, since no one buys their cargo anymore. Cargo of gold, silver, jewels, pearls, fine linen, purple cloth, silk, scarlet cloth, all kinds of scented wood, all kinds of articles of ivory, all kinds of articles of costly wood, bronze, iron, and marble, cinnamon, spice, incense, myrrh, frankincense, wine, oil, fine flour, wheat, cattle, and sheep, horses and chariots, and slaves," that is, human souls. "The fruit for which your soul longed has gone from you, and all your delicacies and your splendors are lost to you, never to be found again. The merchants of these wares who gained wealth from her will stand far off in fear of her torment, weeping and mourning aloud. Alas, alas for the great city that was clothed in fine linen, in purple and scarlet, adorned with gold, with jewels, and with pearls, for in a single hour all this wealth has been laid waste. And all shipmasters and seafaring men, sailors, and all whose trade is on the sea stood far off and cried out as they saw the smoke of her burning, 'What city was like this great city?' And they threw dust on their heads as they wept and mourned, crying out, 'Alas, alas for the great city, where all who had ships at sea grew rich by her wealth. For in a single hour she has been laid waste. Rejoice over her, O heaven, and you saints and apostles and prophets, for God has given judgment for you against her. Then a mighty angel took up a stone like a great millstone and threw it into the sea, saying, "So will Babylon, the great city, be thrown down with violence and will be found no more. And the sound of harpists and musicians, of flute players and trumpeters will be heard in you no more. And a craftsman of any craft will be found in you no more. And the sound of the mill will be heard in you no more. And the light of a lamp will shine in you no more. And the voice of bridegroom and bride will be heard in you no more. For your merchants were the great ones of the earth, and all nations were deceived by your sorcery. And in her was found the blood of prophets and of saints, and of all who have been slain on earth." So notice that these three groups that are mourning the fall of Babylon all have a personal stake in her welfare. And as they mourn, they're not mourning like people who really loved a person. They're just mourning like people who have taken a hit to their bank accounts. They're lamenting how they're not going to be able to make the profits that they were able to make. They're not going to have the luxury and the wealth that they have been able to enjoy. And in fact, all three groups are pictured as standing far off, which I think is interesting. In verse 10, verse 15, and verse 17, they're weeping and they're wailing, but they're standing far off. They're not mourning the way somebody mourns when they've lost somebody who they love dearly. This is the way people grieve when they're just feeling sorry for themselves. All they miss about Rome is the wealth and power she was able to give them. And the chapter ends with this very dramatic demonstration of Babylon's fall. It's actually very similar to Jeremiah chapter 51, when Jeremiah is told about the fall of Babylon, the original Babylon in the Old Testament. In verses 63 and 64, he's told, "When you finish reading this book, tie a stone to it and cast it into the midst of the Euphrates and say, 'Thus shall Babylon sink to rise no more because of the disaster that I am bringing upon her.'" And so God is using the same imagery here about the fall of Rome. He's saying, like the original Babylon, she will be cast down, never to rise again. And with the fall of Babylon, the world would be dramatically changed. You realize that when Rome fell, it plunged the world into what we call the Dark Ages, where everything that they knew and celebrated was lost and gone. This great city will be thrown down and found no more. All of Rome's beauty and power is passing away. Its splendor and its wealth will soon be gone. She was able to tempt and deceive the nations for a time, but judgment is coming swiftly and completely to all those who oppose the kingdom of Christ and his people. And the ones who will miss her will be the ones who were just getting surface-level, physical kinds of rewards for their association. So, that concludes chapter 18. And you might have noticed that there is a hint of what we're going to read about in chapter 19, because there's a fourth group that reacts to the fall of Babylon, and it's not the kings of the earth or the merchants of the earth or the seafaring people of the earth, but it is heaven and heaven's saints and apostles and prophets. They're mentioned there in verse 20, and we'll see more about them in chapter 19. But for now, this is where we'll stop. And I think we can draw some conclusions about the fall of Babylon the Great from these two chapters. First of all, these chapters demonstrate this truth, that friendship with the world is enmity with God. That's exactly what James says in James chapter 4. In James chapter 4 and verse 4, he says, "You adulterous people, do you not know that friendship with the world is enmity with God? Therefore, whoever wishes to be a friend of the world makes himself an enemy of God." Remember, that was the problem with everyone who was deceived by Babylon the Great. They became drunk with the wine of her sexual immorality. They committed sexual immorality with her. They fell for her allure and her temptations, and they exchanged the riches of heaven for the riches of this world. They exchanged the glory of God for created things. And anytime we compromise our faithfulness to God for the allure of pleasure or wealth or power, we do the same thing. We make ourselves God's enemies. And so we need to resist the temptations of this world. We need to resist the influence of the great prostitute, whatever form she takes in our day and age. And we need to be faithful to the God who truly loves us. Secondly, these chapters show us that the world is passing away along with its desires. That's what John says in 1 John chapter 2. 1 John chapter 2 and verse 15. Do not love the world or the things in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. For all that is in the world, the desires of the flesh and the desires of the eyes and pride of life is not from the Father, but is from the world. And the world is passing away along with its desires, but whoever does the will of God abides forever. So many times, the power to resisting temptation really comes down to just having the right perspective. If we are making foolish decisions, it's usually because we're not thinking far enough down the road. We're not looking far enough ahead. We're thinking about the way we feel right now or the way that we want to feel right now. But when we can see the whole picture, when we can see a path ending in destruction, then we're a lot less tempted to go down that path. And so John is instructing us in 1 John with the same kind of picture that he's illustrating in Revelation. The world is passing away along with its desires. Babylon is doomed. Don't go down with a sinking ship. But thirdly, to escape the fate of the world, we must be separate from it. Remember, in Revelation 18 and verse 4, the instruction for God's people was, "Come out of her, lest you take part in her sins, lest you share in her plagues." And really, this is the theme of all of God's judgments against his enemies in the Old Testament and in the New Testament. God had told Israel to separate themselves from Babylon, not to be caught up in Babylon's destruction in the Old Testament. Jesus told his disciples to come out of Jerusalem when judgment was coming to Jerusalem, not to be so attached to that place that when it goes up in flames that you perish with it. And the New Testament is telling us that if we don't want to go down with this world, that we ought to be willing to separate ourselves from it. Last passage, 2 Corinthians chapter 6. 2 Corinthians 6 and verse 14. Do not be unequally yoked with unbelievers. For what partnership has righteousness with lawlessness? Or what fellowship has light with darkness? What accord has Christ with Belial? Or what portion does a believer share with an unbeliever? What agreement has the temple of God with idols? For we are the temple of the living God. As God said, I will make my dwelling among them and walk among them, and I will be their God, and they shall be my people. Therefore, go out from their midst and be separate from them, says the Lord, and touch no unclean thing. Then I will welcome you, and I will be a father to you, and you shall be sons and daughters to me, says the Lord Almighty. When we understand that the world is passing away along with its desires, then we'll understand the Lord's wisdom in telling us to go out from their midst and be separate. And so if we don't fit in with this world, then that's a very good thing. If we don't do the same things that this world does, then that's good. If we don't want the same things that this world wants, then that's good. The citizens of the kingdom of heaven will not fit in with worldly people, worldly organizations, worldly nations, or worldly political parties. And that's quite all right. Because when all of those things pass away, it is the kingdom of heaven that will remain. And the ones who escape the destruction of the world will be those who are separate from it. There's a lot of good instruction for Christians living in the Roman Empire in these chapters. And there's a lot of good instruction for Christians living in whatever empire we live under today. Whether that's the United States of America, or people in other places or other times, Satan uses the same tools against God's people, just in different forms. But the big picture and the big principles are these: that we live in a place that is passing away. And so our hearts and our desires ought to be for what's eternal. Because in the end, the kingdom of heaven is the one that will last forever. There may be somebody here who realizes that you have been seduced by the temptations that this world offers. Maybe you have been falling for the allure of the great prostitute in whatever form she takes today. I hope that as we read God's word, that it does what it's intended to do for us, that it cuts us to the heart and opens us up and shows us ourselves as we really are, and that as we see ourselves as we really are, that we're motivated to make the changes that God wants us to make. So I would encourage you to think about these things and to pray about them, to consider where your affections lie. And if there's somebody here tonight that needs to make some change publicly, you have the opportunity to do that. Maybe you've not yet chosen to come out of the world and to come into the kingdom of heaven. But you can do that by being baptized into Jesus Christ. Or there might be somebody here who has some kind of spiritual need that you want to share with us so that we can pray with you and help you, and we would encourage you to let us know that as well. But if you have some needs that you'd like to make known, you can come to the front while we stand together and sing.